Welcome to a History of Horror podcast, a year-long journey through films throughout the decades, examining across the globe what makes us scared. Hello there, my name's Christopher Brown. When I first thought about this story, I thought, well, you know, let's focus on the 70s and the ghost stories of the 70s, because I think there's something very interesting that happens at that time. But when I kind of, obviously when I went back to my research, I kind of realised that there's a little bit more that we could really touch on around this. So let's, for example, since the 30s, American horror always had a fondness for the supernatural. After all, who can look at something like Dracula and not see an otherworldly terror? But ghost stories, not so much initially. There have been some very notable exceptions, such as like The Cat and the Canary or The Ghoul. But one of the bigger players in terms of this, I would say, was Val Newton, who most notably gave the world Cat People in 1942 for RKO. He was a Russian-born American producer and screenwriter and created really low-budget films for RKO. He originally worked as a writer for New York in MGM's publicity, offering novelizations of popular stories for the magazine racks. And he also wrote some promotional copy. He quit his job in 1932 after his book No Bed of Her Own became popular. Later moved on to write three other novels, but none of those succeeded. He traveled over to Hollywood for a job writing, screenwriting. He ended up being hired by MGM to work as a publicist and assistant. Luton actually had an uncredited writing credit for Gone with the Wind, as he was David O. Shelnick's assistant. O. Shelnick was a producer and a studio executive at MGM. Because of that work, Newton became head of the horror unit at RKO Studios. He only has three rules. Each film had to come in under $150,000 budget, had to run under 75 minutes, and Luton's supervisor would supply the film titles. So Luton initially created Cat People, which was which hit all those targets and made $4 million. Its mixture of mystery, horror, and psychosexual drama about a woman who believes she can turn into a cat when she's sexually aroused caught the public's attention and imagination.
Across the centuries comes this exciting story of a modern girl cursed by an ancient legend. The legend of the cat. Women whose kiss means death, whose love turns them into vicious, snarling beasts of prey.
Twice I've been followed by something that was not human, something that attempted to take my life. I believe that was the cat form of Irena.
Why should she wish to harm you?
Because I'm in love with her husband. It's shut now. Just a minute ago, it was open.
Clark. Leave us, Irena.
He worked with Boris Karloff on Isle of the Dead, The Body Snatcher, and Bedlam, and stood out in this period of time because of the success of Cat People. other and these sensationalist film titles that he was given to work with, he was basically able to do what he wanted. So he focused on things like suggestion, dread, an insidious nature in the horror, and also existentialism, if I'm being honest. I would say, though, that really the Haunted House film didn't really start to get much traction until the 50s, when William Castle started mixing his own carnival charms with the cinema. House on Haunted Hill was made in 1959, directed by Castle and written by Rob White, and it features Vincent Price as a millionaire of Frederick Lauren. He and his fourth wife invited 5 people to the House on Haunted Hill party, whereas if you stay the night, you'll earn $10,000. But as the night progresses, all the guests are trapped inside the house with ghosts, murderers, and terrors. The film really is known for its famous promotional gimmick these days, which used in the film's original theatres called Emergo. William Castle made this pulley system in some theatres, showing the film, which allowed that a plastic skeleton would be flown across the audience at the appropriate time. Thanks in part to this gimmick, the film was a massive success, and Hitchcock took notice of the box office it made when he decided to make his next production, which was Psycho. Castle himself was a Hitchcock fan and would in turn imitate Hitchcock's work himself with Homicidal. But before he made Homicidal, he made a different film, 13 Ghosts, riffing heavily on the Haunted House theme. So again, using the William Castle and Rob White combination, 13 Ghosts stars the child actor Charles Herbert as Buck and Margaret Hamilton as Elaine. It's a very knowing film, playing up the fact that Elaine is called a witch, which points to the fact that obviously she played the Wicked Witch of the West in The Wizard of Oz. The film was filmed in Illusiono, and a special view was needed to see the ghosts. This initially makes people think that the film was shown in 3D when it wasn't. The ghost viewer contained a red filter and a blue filter. So the red filter would cause the ghost image to intensify, while the blue filter would cause the images to fade.
Listen to William Castle, whom the Saturday Evening Post calls the master of movie horror.
Do you believe in ghosts? I do. And you will too. When you come to this theater and see my picture, 13 Ghosts, no more dictation today. When you see 13 ghosts, you'll be given a supernatural viewer like this, which will enable you to penetrate for the first time into the spirit world. It will let you see all 13 of our weird, wonderful, and wildly assorted ghosts.
Now, brace yourself as we take you across the threshold of our haunted mansion, where there's a ghost for everyone in the family. Father, mother, sister, brother. You'll be scared stiff too when you see what they see. 13 ghosts materializing in ectoplasmic color through the magic of Illusiono, the ghost viewer. The ghost of a lion in the basement. The ghost of a murderous cook in the kitchen.
Stop it! Stop it, I say!
The ghost who speaks through the lips of the living.
Death tonight to one of you.
The evil ghost in the bedroom, fighting to take possession of this beautiful girl. You'll feel all the thrills and chills of seeing one ghost multiplied by the magic number 13.
So at this stage, then, we've got an obvious appetite for ghosts and haunted house stories, although, in fairness, there's so little interest in creating films like this that a film called The Haunting from 1963 struggled to get financing. The horror film fans may be surprised the fact that I include this film in a film about American ghost stories, but let me explain. Although it was actually really traditionally classed as a British production. This was more due to financing than design. The director, Robert Wise, approached United Artists with the project, but after much delays, they turned him down. He went to MGM, and MGM could only agree to $1 million budget. He was never going to be able to make the film he wanted with that amount of money, so he flew over to England, and the Edie Levy tax breaks that were available in the UK meant that he could make his budget stretch far further. This budget was designed to help promote and expand the British film industry at the time. The Haunting itself is a psychological horror, produced by Robert Wise and adapted by Nelson Gidding from 1969 novel The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson. It's got a great cast, including Julie Harris, and the story's about a group of paranormal investigators who stay at a haunted house, comes alive. People often frequently call it one of the most frightening films ever made. It's an incredibly slick film, touching whether you believe any of this stuff is real or not, and people questioning their own intellectual and integrity as the story goes on. The film itself is notable for having a well-written gay character, Fedora. It's ambiguous in the source novel, but pulled out and exemplified in the film. It is, without doubt, one of the few films of the time to portray a lesbian as feminine and not predatory. Apparently the censor at the time insisted, though, that any kind of touching was kept to a minimum, and certainly not made in a sensual or sexual way. Initially, when the film was released, it was actually considered to be a bit incoherent. Although, as with a lot of horror, particularly ones that kind of stand the test of time, it found its audience rather than was a big smash hit initially. Martin Scorsese placed The Haunting first on his list of the 11 scariest horror films of all time, and it has been placed numerous times on most frightening or well-made horrors.
Look, I know the supernatural is something that isn't supposed to happen, but it does happen.
Now look, Doc, we're buddies, okay? But don't try to convert me.
I'm trying to prepare you. My name's Marquay, Dr. Marquay, a scientist interested in the supernatural. The unnatural, if you like. I came to Hill House to find the key to another world. Assisting me in this exploration of the unknown was Eleanor, Nell, who could look back into the past. And Theo, something of a witch who could see into the future. This is Luke, who didn't believe in anything. Until evil, patient and waiting, made him change his mind.
Stop it! God. God. Whose hand was I holding?
How many of us take seriously the things we cannot or do not want to understand simply because we are afraid?
Eleanor, you're poor! Did you hear me calling?
This house. You have to watch it every minute.
The Haunting was produced and directed by Robert Wise, brilliant producer of West Side Story. The stars consist of a cross-section of top talent in the world of entertainment. Julie Harris, Claire Bloom, Richard Johnson, Russ Tamblyn.
What does it take to convince you that the dead do not always rest in peace? That some houses, like Hill House, are born bad?
has lots of Gothic influences, which is probably understandable because itself is influenced in its styling from the 1961 British film The Innocents, which itself is based on a short story, The Turn of the Screw by Henry James, about a governess who watches over two children and discovers the house is haunted by ghosts and that the two children are being possessed. Now, to say that suddenly, because of this, America had an appetite for scary haunted house films isn't true. There was always a place for that kind of thing in the UK. There's always a place for that kind of thing in horror generally. As well as obviously short stories, they used to make the most of old-time radio tales, such as, you know, The Mercury Theatre on Air with its War of the Worlds, but also Quiet Please, Suspense, which is notable for having the story Ghost Hunt, which effectively is a found footage horror story about a person who becomes lost or trapped in a haunted house and loses his mind. And then lights out as well with things like Murder Castle, which was based on the true story of H.H. Holmes. That's noticeable because obviously it's based on this kind of house of terror and horrors. And although there isn't a ghost element to it, it certainly still has a frightening kind of menace of and a serial killer kind of tale. These kind of radio plays ran in the 40s and 50s and really kind of showed, I think, that people wanted to know more and enjoy these kind of tales more. And it's really, you know, that kind of stuff that picked up. In 1963, The Haunted Palace was released by AIP Pictures, starring Vincent Price, Lon Chaney Jr. and Debbie Paget. And it's about a story about a village held in the grip of a dead necromancer. It was director Roger Corman, and often regarded as one in his series of eight films influenced by the work of Edgar Allan Poe. Now, the story was marketed as Edgar Allan Poe's The Haunted Palace, but it's actually, the plot is from The Case of Charles Dexter Ward, a novella by H.P. Lovecraft. And The Haunted Palace is a title borrowed from the poem of Poe. I think this is fair to say that the Edgar Allan Poe cycle of films is Roger Corman's probably biggest accolade, made through AIP and collaboration with the writer Richard Matheson. In this short period of time, we have The House of Usher, The Pit and the Pendulum, The Premature Burial, Tales of Terror, The Raven, The Haunted Palace, The Mask of the Red Death, and The Tomb of Ligeia. All but The Premature Burial actually starred Vincent Price as well. And now, Corman worked with set designer Daniel Harler and cinematographer Floyd Crosby on the series. Apparently the story goes that when he first made The Raven, he realised that he still had some shooting days left in his budget. So before he saw the strip down, he created The Terror with the remaining cast and crew on the set. These films are noticeable for their brightness, their gothicness, and also the fact that they're obviously heavily influenced by the colour palette of Hammer.
The Red Death, personalized by the motion picture screen's prince of horror, Vincent Price.
Garotta.
No, I beg of you, mercy, mercy.
With the devil's own darling, Hazel Court.
Lord Satan, send me a demon so I may know I'm to be your wife.
And a lost, virginal angel of innocence, Jane Asher.
I want to help save your soul so you can join me in the glories of hell.
No, never.
She's a woman cursed by Satan Seneschal, whose very existence turns the white rose blood red.
Diamonds, rubies, emeralds, pearls.
Lavishly he plants his corrupting seeds of sin, spreading living terror that not even the unsullied can escape. Nor can one who craves all the forbidden pleasures of the depraved.
Each man creates his own heaven, his own hell.
Let me see your face.
So up until then, the tastes of basic in horror anyway have been for fantastical or gimmicky. These kind of changes as modern audiences' tastes change in the late 60s and early 70s. Rosemary's Baby from 68 was as much a psychological horror film as it was about possession and a demonic baby. Directed by Roman Polanski, based off the 1967 novel by R11. You get another fantastic cast in a high-profile and well-put-together film, with Mia Farrow taking the lead. It was actually produced by William Castle. Again, proving that even if he did come from kind of carnival tricks, he certainly knew how to create something with real power to shock. Farrow plays a pregnant woman who feels that her husband may have made a pact with eccentric neighbours, believing he may have promised them the child to be used as a human sacrifice in occult rituals in exchange for success in his acting career. This effectively was the second film in Polanski's apartment trilogy, which started with Repulsion and finished with The Tenant. Obviously, we've spoken about The Tenant already in our French episode. Each film covers a protagonist who's in an apartment and beset by mysterious and horrific events. Rosemary's Baby was a massive commercial success. It earned over $33 million in the US alone and was created on a reasonably modest budget of $3.2 million. The American Film Institute has ranked the film 9 in its 100 Years, 100 Films list. And it has the National Film Registry marked it as a culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant film. It was very well received as well by the critics. Variety stated, several exhilarating milestones were achieved in Rosemary's Baby, an excellent film version of Ira Levin's diabolical chiller novel. Writer-director Roman Polanski has triumphed in his first US-made pick. The film holds tension without explicit violence or gore. Farrow's performance is outstanding. And Ruth Gordon won an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress. What Rosemary's Baby did at this stage was kind of create a situation where, or certainly mark a situation where realism was important. Bear in mind as well, this was the point that Night of the Living Dead began to reignite and make a ground zero moment for horror in the 70s generally. It could be more violent now, but also taste indicated that people wanted their horror not to be in gothic castles, but on their own doorstep. The Exorcist would be a good example of this. It's about possession rather than ghost stories, but it still utilises plenty of old-school haunted house tropes. Based on a novel of the same name from 1971, the book was actually inspired by the 1949 exorcism of Ronald Dow. They changed the sex of the character and turned it into a 12-year-old girl for the film and the book. And it kind of charts the attempts of her mother and two priests, one of whose faith is failing, in their attempts to exorcise the demon using an old Catholic ritual.
Something beyond comprehension is happening to a little girl on this street, in this house. a man has been sent for as a last resort to try and save her.
It sits well with this cycle of demonic child films that were popular at the time, which obviously started with Rosemary's Baby and also includes The Omen. Now, The Omen from 1976 was directed by Richard Donner and was a big release at the time, starring Gregory Peck. It received mostly positive reviews from critics and was considered by many to be one of the best films of 1976. It's probably most notable now for a couple of death scenes, in particular one in which a character willingly hangs himself at a birthday party attended by children, and a decapitation scene with a sheet of plate glass. It sits interestingly with Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist. Again, these aren't really haunted house stories as such, but what they are is horror brought into the home, and again an idea that a haunted house necessarily does not need to include a big castle, but your own home could be possibly it. Burnt Offerings in 1976 was a mystery horror based on a novel from 1973 directed by Dan Curtis and starred Karen Black and Ollie Reed. It's about a family who moves into an old house that regenerates itself by means of feeding off the life force of whichever occupant is most in sync with the house's energy. Other family members are all killed off, with the survivor awaiting a new family. It won mixed critical acclaim at the time, I think it's fair to say. For example, Roger Ebert calls the film a mystery alright, including that Burnt Offering just persists until it occurs to us that the characters are the only ones in the theatre who don't know what's going to happen next. Variety stated the horrors expressed through sudden murderous impulses felt by Black and Reed. Apparently it might have been interesting if director Dan Curtis hadn't relied strictly on formula treatment. I think it's fair to say that it's probably aged better than you probably would have imagined for a film of getting those kind of reviews. It is silly schlock, but for me certainly does have some style and implications that work quite well. It sits interestingly between old school traditional haunted house fare and this taste for new realism that was in the American mainstream at the time. This might indicate why it got bad reviews, because people, the slightly more schlocky fun elements weren't really as perceived or read as well as people would have liked in comparison to, say, for example, films like The Exorcist or The Omen. Certainly when you put the two together, you can see why Burnt Offerings would be criticised. However, with more modern eyes, I think you can enjoy some of the ham a little bit more, and its haunted house shtick makes an interesting juxtaposition. This mix that Burnt Offerings offered of a mixture between realism and the absurd peaked almost certainly with Amityville Horror. The film tells the allegedly true life tale based on a book of George and Kathy Lutz and their three children, who moved to 112 Ocean Avenue, a large Dutch colonial house situated in Amityville on the south shore of Long Island. 13 months before the Lutz moved in, Ronald DeFeo Jr. shot and killed six members of his family in the home. Apparently, after 28 days, the Lutzes left the house, claiming they'd been terrorized by paranormal phenomena. The book was turned into a film in 1979, directed by Stuart Rosenberg, and actually is the first film of what has became a franchise, and a remake was produced in 2005. Again, probably due to its schlocky nature, the film received generally negative reviews, calling it, and Roger Ebert called it, dreary and depressing. Despite its failure, The Amityville Horror was actually a commercial success, one of the most successful films produced by an independent studio at the time, and the most profitable AIP release since The Bourne Losers in 1968. The film grossed a total of $86 million in the US box office. The film, and let's just rattle through these, spawned numerous films, all of dubious quality, if we're being honest. Amityville 2, The Possession, Amityville 3D, The Demon, Amityville 4, The Evil Escapes, The Amityville Curse, Amityville 1992, It's About Time, Amityville, A New Generation, Amityville Dollhouse, Evil Never Dies, The Amityville Horror in 2005, and then again another cycle of Amityville-based spin-offs. The Amityville Haunting, The Amityville Asylum, Amityville Death House from February 2004, Amityville Playhouse, Amityville The Reawakening. These are all films that have kind of basically spun out, used the Amityville name and a direct-to-video schlock.
It's the kind of house they don't build anymore. A relic of a time when the world wasn't in such a hurry. When there was still time for a little charm and elegance. It has stood empty for a long while. And at the price, it is a bargain. For a growing young family, it is almost too good to be true.
What do you think?
I love it.
James Brolin, Margot Kidder, Rod Steiger, in the Amityville Horror.
God's peace in this house.
Kathy? Father Delaney, there's something very important.
After the Lutz family moved into their dream house, they were running for their lives. What happened to them is an experience in terror you will never forget, and you will believe in the Amityville Horror. From the best-selling book that made millions believe in the unbelievable, the Amityville Horror.
So by the 1980s, we'd kind of hit a peak. Let's start off with The Changeling, a horror film directed by Peter Madoc and starring George C. Scott. The story is based upon events that writer Russell Hunter said he experienced while living in the Henry Treat Rogers Mansion in Colorado. The story tells about John Russell, who played by George C. Scott, a composer, living in New York, moves cross-country to Washington State following the details of his wife and daughter in a traffic accident they're on a winter vacation in upstate New York. John decides to rent an old, eerie, kind of Victorian-era mansion and begins to try and piece his life together. However, he discovers there's an unhappy ghost of a murdered young boy in the home. The ghost makes its presence felt by various phenomena such as shattering windows, opening and shutting doors, and manifesting itself during a seance. John decides to investigate the identity of the dead child and finds it's a mystery linked to a powerful local family, and he sets about trying to solve what's going on. The Fog from 1980, from John Carpenter, who we've spoken about before in our Masters of Horror series, tells the story of a strange glowing fog that sweeps over a small coastal town in California, bringing with it vengeful ghosts of mariners killed in a shipwreck 100 years prior, all out for revenge. It was a commercial success, despite the fact that it received mixed reviews. It is a bit silly, and probably not considered as one of Carpenter's best now, but for me, a certain fondness. The Shining also came in 1980, directed by Stanley Kubrick, based on the Stephen King novel of the same name, although the film takes the novel as a starting point and branches out. In the film, Jack Torrance, a writer and alcoholic, takes a job as a caretaker in an Overlook Hotel. But his psychic son is able to kind of kickstart supernatural elements in the house. And the family become trapped by a snowstorm. And Jack, influenced by these supernatural presences, decides that he must kind of integrate them far more in the house by murdering his wife and son. The film was noticeable because, unlike Kubrick films in the past, which kind of built on word of mouth, The Shining was released as a mass market movie, opening at first in just a couple of cities, then nationwide in a big push a month later. Again, like a lot of films made by Kubrick and also horror, initially the opinions on it were mixed in terms of critical response, but now it's been kind of reassessed as one of the greatest horror films ever made. In 1981, Ghost Story, directed by John Irvin and based on the book by Peter Straub, features a great cast including Fred Astaire again, and it made a reasonable amount of money, $23 million. However, it was mixed response, and in fairness, hasn't really kind of revived itself in the same way that, say, something like The Shining has, receiving still quite negative, mainly due to the fact that it does kind of strip out a lot of Straub's source material in the novel, making it a tad over simplistic for many and not the story that people hoped it would be. The Entity, also from 1981, although actually released probably in worldwide theatres until September 82, and then only really in the United States in 1983. Apparently, the director, Sidney J. Fury, told journalist Michael Doyle in 2012 that he did not consider The Entity to be a horror film, despite its extreme imagery, atmosphere, and indeed plot, which includes a woman being raped by a ghost. Instead, he considered The Entity to be more a supernatural suspense movie. Apparently also based on a true life account, Fury decided to actually not look too much into that part of the story, relying on the actors and actresses and a writer to kind of come up with the tale for him. This would help him avoid having too strong an opinion on what actually did happen. Probably one of the last of these big tentpole ghost story that kind of litters through. And as I said, you know, not just the 70s, but the 80s as well, is Poltergeist, directed by Tobe Hooper and co-written by Steven Spielberg. There's also talk the fact that Spielberg probably helped direct the film as well. Certainly it has some of his hallmark direction all over it. The story's about the Freeling family, who live in a California housing development, only to find out that it's haunted by ghosts. The ghosts communicate only with Carol Ann, through the family's television set, and are under the control of a demon known as the Beast. The ghosts attach themselves to Carol Ann's life, believing that she will help lead them into the light. They abduct her through a bedroom closet, which is actually a portal to their dimension. Most of the story actually involves efforts to rescue her on the part of the family, a group of parapsychologists and a spirit medium. Carol Ann is eventually retrieved, and it becomes apparent that the reason why these ghosts are trying to find their way home is the fact that the house is built on an old Indian burial ground. There were numerous sequels to this film as well, and now a remake. At this stage, we need to point out, therefore, that ghost stories don't suddenly vanish off the map. They just kind of slip into VHS, straight to video, and the boom at home video entertainment. Films like Witchboard and The Unnameable. Our mainstream tastes were changing there. And ghost stories as such shift from being horror films, maybe, to being far lighter fare, such as Ghostbusters, Beetlejuice, and High Spirits.
Before there was Casper.
Look!
It's the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
Before there was Flubber. Before there was Men in Black.
Hey, anybody see a ghost?
There were only... The Ghostbusters.
The city is headed for a disaster of biblical proportion.
Fire and brimstone, earthquakes, volcanoes,
dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria.
Enough, I get the point.
Celebrate the 15th anniversary.
We're gonna play Twister, we're gonna do some breakdancing.
Of one of the funniest movies of all time.
What are you supposed to be, some kind of a cosmonaut?
No, we're exterminators. Somebody saw a cockroach up on 12.
Ghostbusters, the movie that scared us with spirits.
Generally, you don't see that kind of behavior in a major appliance.
Wowed us with gadgets.
Oh, nice shooting, Tex.
And covered us with slime.
He slimed me.
I feel so funky.
Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Sigourney Weaver, Harold Ramis, Rick Moranis, Annie Potts, Ernie Hudson, in a film by Ivan Reitman.
You have been a participant in the biggest interdimensional cross-rip since the Tunguska blast of 1909.
Felt great.
Also available, the sequel to the runaway hit, Ghostbusters 2.
We're the beautiful, we're the only... Ghostbusters!
Ghostbusters, 15th Anniversary Collector's Edition. Digitally remastered for the first time ever.
Well, there's something you don't see every day.
And Ghostbusters 2 on video cassette and DVD.
We came, we saw, we kicked it.
It isn't until the late 90s that we start seeing again more breakthrough haunted fare. Now, these aren't haunted house stories, though. The Blair Witch Project, for example, the found footage film, involves a witch that's able to control the woods around her, and the found footage of our film crew that get lost there. The reason why the Blair Witch Project was probably such a success was that people hadn't seen such a gimmick used for a long time. And it made $248 million worldwide based on word of mouth and buzz pre-release. It also benefited from a lengthy documentary that was screened, supposedly saying that the events contained within the film were actually real. this found footage motif used for ghosts or witchy or supernatural tales flares up again in 2007 with Paranormal Activity, again found footage, which was created on an incredibly low budget by filmmaker Oren Peli. It's the first in what is now a franchise, centered on a young couple, Katie and Mika, who are haunted by a supernatural presence in their own home. They decide to film it to find out what's going on, and originally shown as an independent feature at film festivals, again generating buzz on the internet at this time. The film was acquired by Paramount. It had some scenes snipped out of it to take away some, to add to some of the mystery. And a new ending was added to it to give the film potential longevity for a franchise. It was given a limited release, but then released nationwide in 2009 and made a lot of money for such a low budget film, $193 million worldwide. It's the most it beats Blair Witch as now the most profitable film ever made based on its return on investment. Although it's fair to say that that's probably excluding its marketing costs. There were sequels, Paranormal 2, 3, 4, and a spin-off called The Marked Ones. We're expecting another film, Paranormal Activity, The Ghost Dimension, planned to be released on October 23rd, 2015. So, meanwhile on television, this concept of ghostly tales has increased radically. In the UK, we have Most Haunted, or did have Most Haunted, I think it's returned last year for a brief run, which has ran for years, featuring a group of paranormal investigators. It has to be said, though, that Most Haunted seems tame in comparison to its discoveries when compared to things like these Ghost Hunter TV series that are over in the US, which seem to increasingly feature voices of dead ones coming through using technical equipment. Warm and cold patches, another spooky goings-on, which can be either proof of terrifying possibilities of monsters or ghosts, or indeed can be proved how susceptible people can be to suggestion.
When Ghost Hunters went global,
what the hell is that?
It documented some of the world's most legendary haunted locations.
People have gone missing here, and they're still out here screaming.
Now, every Monday at 8:30, we'll see what they found.
Did you see something up there?
Whoa!
This isn't friendly.
We got something.
What was that?
Ghost Hunters International, Mondays, 8:30 on Sci-Fi.
Currently, I think it's fair to say, our own present-day master of horror is probably one man, a guy called James Wan, who started off creating Saw, then made Dead Silence and Death Sentence, which received lukewarm responses, and then, in 2010, premiered a film called Insidious, which tied himself in with Oren Peli, starring Patrick Wilson and Rose Byrne. The film was originally made independently, but it's because James Wan wanted to have creative control of the project and make a film that was different from the gore that had become synonymous and indeed created its own scene due to Saw. The film itself, and indeed the films that he created afterwards, are designed to be built for loud, noisy, rambunctious cinemas. I think what's noticeable about Insidious is its first scare, which is a jump scare, loud and aggressive, but then is followed by lengthy an alarm going off, almost to kind of mask the noise and chatter that such a scare would generate in a cinema. Wan's films, which include two Insidious sequels and The Conjuring, are now designed as haunted house jump scare freak shows, ramping up the horror to incredible degrees. The Conjuring is at its heart, and its spin-off film Annabelle, a hark back to these films we've discussed in the 70s of horror, and particularly films like Amityville, of horror manifesting itself to a family in a home which could be much like your own. These films, such also including films like, you know, The Haunting of Connecticut, kind of play in that fear that a house could be, you know, containing spirits within. But whereas The Haunting of Connecticut kind of ramps up and uses scares, James Wan's films seem to almost kind of bounce out the trap and run at their audience screaming and waving their arms. It's a result that's been very popular and successful. The Conjuring in particular is seen as being a modern day classic with genuine frights in it. Slightly more jaded audiences have also kind of used this kind of extreme full on nature to kind of criticize them, stating that, you know, it's jump over style or substance. But I think I think for me, they're interesting films. They acknowledge the fact that our cinemas can be quite noisy and rambunctious places these days, that people can be bored quite quick because of the internet and because of mobile technology. They demand your attention, and on the big screen, they can be quite intoxicating thrill rides. Certainly, I think when you compare this to 1963's The Haunting, you can see exactly how our tastes, our ideas, and our enjoyment of film has changed.
Right, it's 9:18. We're headed down into the cellar where the door's just opened on its own.
You give us a sign that you want to communicate with us.
Nothing.
What are you guys?
Well, we've been called ghost hunters, paranormal researchers.
But we prefer to be known simply as Ed and Lorraine Warren.
There's someone here that would like to talk to you.
There's something horrible happening in my house.
It's November 1st, 1971. I'm sitting here with Carolyn Perrin, who, with her family, has been experiencing supernatural occurrences.
You picking up anything in here, hon?
Something awful happened here, Ed.
What is it?
Whatever Lorraine sees, feels, touches, it takes a toll on her. A little piece each time.
You have a lot of spirits in here, but there's one that I'm most worried about because it is so hateful. Here.
That's not gonna help.
This thing has latched itself to your family.
Father, we've never seen nothing like this.
I'm coming with you.
No way. I can't lose you.
There's a lady in a dirty nightgown that I see in my dreams. She's standing in front of my mom's bed.
Do you want to see him?
Yeah.
When the music stops, you see him in the mirror standing behind you.
Look what she made me do.
Right, well, thanks very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that. If you want to get hold of me, please do. My email address is historyofhorrorpodcast@gmail.com. You can go to the website, historyofhorrorpodcast.com, and look at any of the articles and stories that I've put up and videos, and see what you like. Get in touch. You can do. That's at @orange_monkey on Twitter. Including Stuart Barr, who's at Max Ren with two N's, who asked me about Val Luton, in fact, so gave me a good prod and a reminder to include him in this episode. So thanks very much for that. I kind of padded this bit out a little bit after speaking to you about it. I think, yeah, I mean, you know, there's one of those issues, this kind of stuff that I'm going to miss stuff out, I think. I'm a bit worried. But if there's something you think I've desperately missed out that you want me to include, I'm sure there's ways to do that, so please let me know. Anyway, so I did get another one out, another podcast out, so you've got two on the trot. Hope that's not been too much of a problem for you, you know. Hope you're fine with that and you've enjoyed what I've put together. We stick with America and a similar kind of period. While our big Hollywood films and, you know, big money spurs in the cinemas, there's something else going on as well. The grind houses of America and the flea pits of the UK, and indeed the B-reel, B-movie scene generally, creates a very particular kind of air. So we're going to travel down to 42nd Street next for the grindhouses and flea pits and really enjoy what is for many a backbone of the history of horror and exploitation generally of American grindhouse and exploitation generally. So until then, take care and I'll speak to you soon. Goodbye.